All right. We don't want to waste any more time here. We have a lot of talking to do here. We've got a great panel to do it. Welcome to The Nose, our weekly cultural roundtable. Jim Chapdelaine is an Emmy Award-winning musician, producer, composer, recording engineer, patient advocate for people with rare cancers. Rich Holland is a principal and design director at CoLab. Irene Papoulis is a lecturer at the Alan K. Smith Center for Writing and Rhetoric at Trinity College. As of Monday, she will have appeared on our station 3 times in, 8 days or something. So I don't know. She gets her own parking space here now or something. So a little bit later in the show, we're going to gravitate towards the end of the Democratic National Convention for a meditation about oratory. We've been lively on email today debating the nature of oratory and maybe specifically whether certain people are held to different sets of standards, whether women get criticized when they appear to yell when they're giving a speech. And we'll also just sort of talk about the general nature, purpose, and effectiveness of political oratory here in 2016. But before we do that, we want to talk about the night of. Writer Michael Chabon, I think that's how you say his name. I think it might not be how you say his name. But anyway, writer Michael Chabon explains the hold New York City has over the writer Richard Price and his protagonists. It gives him shape, explains him, demarcates the upper limit of what he can imagine and the depth to which he can sink. New York is an ideal he can fail to live up to, a con game, a baggie filled with baby laxative, a set of bad habits, the collective bonehead MO of 8 million repeat offenders. In HBO's The Night Of, we meet 3 such characters kind of defined at their upper and lower limits by New York City. John Stone is an unkempt and macabre-ish jailhouse lawyer whose dreams include a high-profile case with a big paycheck. Just such a case drops into his lap when a naive young Muslim American has a bloody tabloid-ready murder case pinned to him, and Detective Box, a loner who prefers opera and reading to the company of his peers, wrestles with that case that is both open and shut and strangely ajar. There are we've only seen 3 parts of this 8-part series. That's what's aired so far on HBO. I want to reassure you we cannot possibly spoil it because we don't know what's going on, but we know whether we like it or not, and that's where we're going to begin. And so, Irene, I'll begin with you. If you had to tell somebody one reason to watch this show, what would you tell them?
Oh, because it's first of all, John Turturro, who is just there's a lot of great actors, but I love in it. So that's one thing. But it's so rich and detailed and complicated and textured. It's a crime drama, but it's got so much else going on, and it's just deliciously well done, and it just sucks you right in.
Speaking of John Turturro, he plays John Stone. He is a begrimed, messy jailhouse lawyer with a perpetually slightly dirty-looking overcoat and sandals, which he wears because he has terrible psoriasis. Here in one of Irene's favorite clips, we hear John Turturro as John Stone visiting his allergist / dermatologist.
Are you wearing perfume?
Cologne, Paco Rabanne, for men.
Yes, I know, it's for men. Where?
Around my ankles to counteract the smell of the neosporin.
Neosporin smells like maple syrup. What's wrong with that?
At the pancake house, nothing.
And if I told you it's an allergic reaction to cologne that's hastening the spread?
Then that would be ironic.
Taking your antihistamines?
I can't. They knocked me out halfway into the next day.
Do you want to get better or not?
I do.
Throw out the Paco Rabanne and the chopsticks. Start taking your antihistamines. Pick up some saran wrap and Crisco. Apply a large dollop to each foot morning and night and wrap them up.
You're kidding, right? I can't walk around in public like that.
Saran wrap is clear. No one will even notice. Do it. Come back and see me in a week, and we will marvel together at the improvement.
Why not some WD-40 in a Glad cinch sack?
So, Jim Chapdelaine, poor John Stone, the chopsticks to which the doctor refers are these ever-present chopsticks with which he scratches himself in hard-to-reach places, either his back or some little cranny of his sandals that he wants to get into. And somehow or other, this psoriasis, I don't know, I have all kinds of ideas personally about what it is as a working metaphor. But there's a way in which this guy's outsider and really outcast status is driven home by this disorder.
Well, it certainly amplifies everything that he is. And I was thinking as you introduced these characters, when you got to Box, the opera-loving, contrarian detective, that in lesser hands, lesser actors, these could be cartoonish figures. Look, well, let's just give the lawyer psoriasis. Let's make this guy an opera lover. And they're not at all. Totoro just sort of totally inhabits that to the point where when he goes to the 12-step program for people or whatever, the support group for psoriasis people, psoriasis or us, I think that's actually one of the first times we see people laughing. It's the moment of humor. I was kind of waiting for a long time. Do these people laugh, or is this like really grim world that they inhabit, devoid of humor? But it's not. It's just sort of jailhouse humor.
Do they really even have self-help groups for psoriasis?
I would think. Well, if you've ever seen somebody with really bad or known somebody, it can be crippling.
It's torture.
For people.
Yeah. Anything that itches, right, is private torture.
Yeah.
So, Rich, we've got three outsiders here, really. Detective Box is this guy whose erudition seems to place him apart from the rest of the cops around him. But the real outsider is Nazir Khan, this very young guy, but old enough to be an adult in the jail system, who in a momentary act of slight rebellion borrows his father's taxi cab for a night on the town. And the night on the town just goes right off the rails, and he winds up with this murder pinned to him. But we really do see in the depiction of both Naz and his parents what it really means to be an outsider in America in 2016.
The interesting thing about this character for me is that I'm watching him slowly grow to rebel against that outside position. He was confronted by these two black guys in the street that said something to him about where's
towel,
your bomb
or
something?
Head,
where's your bomb, Mustafa?
Yeah,
I believe is what they had said, and I expected from how he was introduced to us about 15 or 20 minutes before then that he would just keep walking away, but he stopped in his tracks and turned around and went to confront them. Mm-hmm. And there's something about him that's already seeming like he's being fed up with being cast like this. And I'm fascinated to see how he continues to evolve with that. He's prepared to, at this point, stand up to, just about anyone in certain ways.
Yeah, because it's interesting because he's an outsider, but he's also, he's from New York. He grew up in New York, so mm-hmm. he's a regular New Yorker in a lot of ways. But since he's Muslim American, he's put into that outsider category.
There was a place where that was actually where I read that there was a scene where that was drawn really beautifully for me. I'm sure it's not a spoiler at this point that this guy is going through the process of being arrested.
The slow wheels of justice.
Exactly. And there's a point in which this Box character hands him a set of clothes to wear
because
they took. Yeah, the detective hands him a set of clothes because they had taken all of his clothes away. And I'm trying to decide what Box was thinking, this detective, when he made the selection of clothing. He gives this kid a Harvard shirt to put on. And then the first place that we see him is in this car filled with folks who clearly are not Harvard folks. Right. And it pushed him that much more to the outside.
Yeah, they're on their way to Rikers Island.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, right.
I think it's important to know about Naz, too, is that what we see of him in the very beginning when he is doing homework for the basketball team is that he desperately wants to be American, mm-hmm. that his family is Pakistani, and maybe of moderation. They're certainly not. They just want to live the American dream. But he's born in America, and he's wrestling with both of these sort of institutions, but is eager for the acceptance of his peers and can't quite figure out how to get it. But it seems like he's on the verge of getting it when things go south.
Right. So this character is played by Riz Ahmed. He's a very up-and-coming actor. People saw him in movies like Four Lions and Nightcrawler. You will see him soon in the new Jason Bourne movie, and then you will see him in Rogue One, the much-talked-about Star Wars spinoff. So you're buying low with Riz Ahmed. You can sell high. But in the movie, he does have this sort of doe-like innocence, these big saucer eyes, and this very gentle demeanor for the most part, so much so that he's twice compared to hoofed animals in their infancy. Ben Schenkman checking him in or being aware of him at the jailhouse at the beginning calls him Bambi. And at another point, Michael Kenneth Williams, who we talked about last week, Michael Kenneth Williams, so amazing as Omar on The Wire and Chalky White in Boardwalk Empire, now plays this kind of king of Rikers Island and gives a speech to young Riz Ahmed playing Nas about another kind of hoofed infant animal.
Your people eat veal, right?
Sometimes.
But only blessed, right? I respect that.
Thank you.
Listen to you. More polite. See, the reason it feels like silk is because on the day it's born, they keep it in a dark crate. So small it can't even turn around. And it stays there, half blind in the dark, drinking baby formula, waiting to die. There are some bad people in here, but I could protect you. Nasir, do you want my protection? Or do you prefer dead in the shower with your brains bashed in, guts on the floor? It's up to you.
So in just a couple of seconds, I want to turn Jim and Rich both loose on some of the design and lighting and look of this and sound of this thing. But before we do that, we really do have to talk about Richard Price. Richard Price, an amazing novelist and then a guy who launched himself into the world of screenwriting, famously wrote The Color of Money's screenplay and then Sea of Love, but really became known for The Wire. The Wire, where he didn't write every episode, but he wrote enough of them so that his dialogue signature is all over that series, and it's all over this series. And Irene, he's always looking for that sweet spot, right? The sweet spot between the way people talk in natural urban environments and then a kind of eloquence that he wants them to have without it seeming forced. How good a job does he do here?
Oh, my God, such a good job. And that's part of why it's so good to watch, even for those of us who are not necessarily crime drama people. You know, there's so much beauty in it. So I don't know. So do we? I can't think of a specific example. It's hard to, you know.
I can, yeah. Actually. It was exactly in that scene that you were just playing with the veal. So he was talking the way that you would expect him to talk. You heard the bleep and everything else over the air. But then he went to this place where it became almost biblical how he was speaking about things. He asked Nasir to give him his hand. He said, "Give me a hand." And he didn't initially. And then he repeated it as this way, "Give me your hand," says I. And he had a tendency to construct some of his statements that way. And it has this sort of beautiful elegance and this primal grit that's attached to
Michael
that elegance.
Michael K. Williams, too, in every role, somehow brings that measure of authority to his role that's really sort of unsettling almost in his authenticity.
And that's where the humor is, maybe. You know, even though it's not like really funny scenes, there's like a really subtle humor. Like,
I think there's a lot of humor.
If you like
Elmore Leonard and Richard Price, who are the two, you know, reigning dialogue writers of our generation, you love, I mean, there's a moment where Turturro is looking at this snack machine, a vending machine in the police office, police station, and he goes, Bloomberg would be appalled by the snacks here. Yeah. You know, just like a little line like that. Or one of my favorites is he's talking to the prosecutor, played, I might say, by Jeannie Berlin, daughter of Elaine May, the original Heartbreak Kid girl. Anyway, talking to the prosecutor, and he goes, he's talking about maybe finding a plea for this. And he says, you know, we don't want this turning into another Abu Ghraib.
Yeah.
Which is such a tenuous connection.
But you know, the humor you're talking about is humor that's conveyed to us, the watcher. I'm talking about actual humor within it's not a lot of, hey, did you hear the one about? It's not like that.
No.
But those moments are hard to come by.
Yeah. I'd also add that in addition to the dialogue, it's the characterization that I love, that I think he does so well. I mean, the whole idea of feeling like a failure that the John Turturro character has, you know, like having, you know, like all these people who are struggling and there's circumstances beyond them, I mean, you know, beyond their control, and they're just not making it the way they want to make it, but they're so sort of passionate at the same time. Mm-hmm. And there's so many people, characters that are like that, that you just identify with them in a way, but you cringe also at the same time because you can see how they're trapped and they're in some cases trapping themselves. Yeah. It's such a beautiful characterization.
And they keep breaking out of that trap too, which to me is the lovely part of it. And that's the one thing that I'm noticing between John and his client, that they seem initially to be on opposite ends of the spectrum, right? Where, you know, one's this highly cynical, crass kind of guy, and on the other end is this
Bambi.
Yeah, naive Bambi, sweet kid. And I'm watching them kind of move closer to the center, sort of like draw each other out of their extremes. There was a conversation that they had about the detective, which to me was my favorite line in this entire piece. Where John Turturro was trying to get this kid to stop talking to the detective, and I get the sense that this kid thinks that he could one up the detective and charm him into trusting
or tell him the truth.
I'm not so sure about that yet. Which is the nice thing about this. I'm not sure about anything yet. And he turns to him and says, like, he's a masterful oppressor. A subtle beast.
Right. Oh, right. That's
where
right.
the
yep.
heck does language like that come from in this conversation?
And then Nas repeats that to his parents.
Yeah.
Like,
right,
it's
right.
like a
As though he thought of it.
A phrase that he's learned. He's a subtle beast.
Right. You know, there's
like that's a thing.
Let me just read a little tweet from the Twitters because it's a great observation. Brian Murphy is tweeting. It's a great show about working and labor and routines. The beat with the desk sergeant's shift change was so elegant. I know exactly what he's referring to. There's a moment, Ben Shankman from Angels in America is one desk sergeant. There's a moment where he's leaving and another guy's coming. And I think there's a whole thing where one of them takes off his glasses and the other one puts on his reading glasses.
Right,
You just sort of, it is, there's something balletic about this. There's like just this little, beautiful little moment in the change of the night. So I want to come back to the questions of morality in this, which are very pressing. But I do want to give a few of you, because I know that you have things to say about it, just a sense, Jim, about the look and feel and sound of this series.
Well, going to the scene, I want to call him Omar, but I can't.
Yeah, that's what I keep calling him to.
Michael K. Williams is sort of delivering his this series of unfortunate options to Nas. It's so dark and green and fluorescent and oppressive. The lighting is it's not distracting in the least way, but it creates this ambience that, like I said earlier, to me, this is an indie film with a major label budget, and it's really they're masterful about color correction, the way they frame shots, the edits are really brilliant. They might use a machine and pan to another machine, and suddenly we're in another place, but it is not a deceptive act. It's just to get us to the other place. The pacing is perfect. They allow everyone to act. And I keep getting back to this fluorescent thing, which I've never liked fluorescent light. Mm-hmm. I think we all like this nice warm light. Mm. But we find ourselves in these institutional environments where it's there. And it always suggests less optimism to me. And that's pervasive and hovering everywhere here with this stuff, with the cinematography, everything.
Let's go to our design guy about this.
Well, to get really wonky with what was going on with the light, they've taken the key light out. The key light is the thing that causes definition in shots. It separates you from backgrounds and pulls you forward. They've neutralize that as much as possible, so the entire production feels like there's this layer of this filter, this grime filter that sits over the entire thing that blends it all into one kind of mushy bed. And on the rare occasion that there actually is a strong light source in these films, it misses the characters completely. It might hit an elbow but completely miss the face and the point of action. There's a way that they're trying to turn this into sort of those impressionist painters that cropped abstractly and
when
painted
they do
with mud.
Force you to focus, everything is out of focus except the thing that they want you to look at, and they're very subtle about that.
Yeah. That's the lens choice, but not the light choice.
It works great with what you're saying because you really focus when you haven't been asked to.
Right. All right, I also do want to talk a little bit about the way morality comes up here in different senses, Irene. And I know from our emails, I'm the only person who feels this way, but I do feel as though Torturo's character is kind of being sold to us as this sort of third-string apostle. You know, he has this billowing trench coat on all the time. He doesn't seem to own the kind of suits that lawyers wear, although he's even given a card and told to go see somebody about that. And he's wearing sandals because of the terrible psoriasis on his feet. Everybody who greets him throughout the first three episodes starts with, "How's the feet?" Everybody, you know, or his ex-wife looks at him and goes, "Oh, it seems like it's getting a little worse." That's how everybody addresses him. So he's both a third-string apostle and a leper, you know. But there's this sense anyway that he's this bearer of a kind of morality that isn't available elsewhere, right? We were told repeatedly, the truth is not your friend. The truth doesn't work. The justice system doesn't really dispense justice the way you think it should. But I feel like there are a lot of conversations, and we'll hear one in just a second, Irene, where the characters are at least trying to talk about, well, what is right? You know, what's the right thing to do?
Though at the same time, I don't know. I feel like I'm not. He first seems to be that way, but then I feel like at least for me as a viewer, I start to think, wait a minute, is he really the moral center, or is he corrupt? And then I sort of went back up, and I've gone on this sine curve of thoughts about that. So I think that's part of why it's interesting too, in terms of we don't necessarily know. And so there's that element of plot, too. Mm-hmm. That's another thing about Richard Price. Like, you don't really know. He sort of keeps you going. He keeps, like, jerks you around from one thing to the other. Like, where is the moral center?
Right. He's an imperfect apostle. He's a grasping, concupiscent apostle.
The apostle
psoriasis.
But to your point, Colin, the way this script is written, I'm not being given nearly enough language to understand who these people are. So I'm watching shots and what's in the shots to try get the cues that I need.
And also the music.
And to your point, Colin, he's constantly walking in situations where his arms are outstretched like he's being crucified.
Right.
He's the only one that actually gets searched. That gets searched with his arms fully outstretched like that.
Oh, there's a lot of patting down in the show and the indignities of being patted down. I just do want to play this clip. This does include the snack machine moment. This is John Turturro as this lawyer, John Stone, with the amazing Bill Camp as this detective Box. Here we go.
That's a feat.
Embarrassing. Thanks for asking. How's the investigation?
Clear by the minute.
Oh, I ducked that.
I want to talk to the boy again.
Yeah, I want to live forever.
I had to ask.
You did. But did you before?
Didn't have to before. You hadn't swooped down on him yet.
Swooped? That's a strong word.
I feel for him.
I'm sure you do.
I do. I let him talk to his distraught parents.
Yeah? You tape it?
This is a little out of your league, isn't it, John?
Bloomberg would have been appalled by the snacks, yeah.
You're not going to get rich off it, but that's what you're thinking. Going to be the shortest trial in history.
Yeah? Is that why you haven't charged him? Doesn't feel right for it, does he? Something in your gut isn't liking him for this, and you can't bring yourself to pull the switch.
And Jim, this sounds like this very startlingly honest moment between the two of them. They're both telling the truth for once. Right there, or at least Turturro is telling the truth to Camp, saying, you know, there's something wrong with this whole thing, and we both know it.
Yeah, no doubt. That's a key moment of I guess that would be a little bit of a come to Jesus moment for both of them. I think they both want to tell the truth. They both have their own truth, but they both have a job to do. And I don't want to say what I hope Detective Box is going to do. Naturally, I hope he's going to evolve into this thing correctly, but I don't expect him to, because that's not his job. And I think everyone in this thing has a role to play. Even Michael K. Williams' character mm-hmm. has a really strong role to play. And these are predefined for them to walk into. So, yeah, that's a really important moment. But it is that one moment where they can face each other and say, look, this is crazy. And but off we go.
And we really don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it's not the kind of thing that you can predict Mm-mm. by watching it. And Mm-mm. that's another thing I love about it. Like, we don't know if he's going to end, you know, what's going to happen. So,
all right. But, one more thing from Rich, and then we're going to take a break, so we'll have time for our other thing.
But in terms of the issue of morality, there's this thing that's – what seemed to happen in that scene and is happening in other scenes is that I'm not clear what their compass really is. Mm-hmm. We're getting a sense that John Turturro wants the truth and believes in the truth, but he also rejects it. These are folks who are caught up in process, and that the process seems to supersede what their convictions and their beliefs are at all points.
I agree with that, and I do think that one of the messages that we hear again and again in different ways, and believe it or not, it's going to come up in the next discussion that we have, is it's not enough just to be pure of heart. You've also got to understand how this game is played. If you don't, you're useless to everybody, right? That, you know, learn the codes, learn the rules, figure out how the game works. Don't just sit there insisting on your own purity. That's not going to be good enough. It almost never is. All right. It's called The Night Of. It's on Sunday nights. I can't tape it or anything like that. I have to watch it right away. I have to know as soon as possible what's happening. It is full of wonderful actors. We haven't mentioned them all yet, but we don't have time to. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about political oratory when we do. All right, we are back. This is The Nose, and they're so excited to talk about The Night Of that they can't stop during the break. It is the kind of thing when you really want to talk to other people about it once you see it. With us, Jim Chapdelaine, a musician and producer extraordinaire, Rich Holland, principal and design director at CoLab, Irene Papoulis from Trinity College. You can hear her again on Monday. She'll be talking about Losers and Losing with Brian Slattery.
Irene's chair actually has her name on the back.
That's right. She's getting one of those little canvas director's chairs.
Yeah, I'm an expert on losers.
Yeah. Actually, really, if there were no other reason to tune into Monday's show, Irene's soliloquy about how she identifies or why she identifies, speaking of outcasts, with Gregor Samsa from Kafka's Metamorphosis is worth tuning in for.
She also has an apple in her back.
Right. I thought it was one of the funniest things. Maybe it's because I know you, but I thought it was just hilarious. So we recorded that a few days ago, and it's just great. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. It's time to talk about political oratory. Last night, we wrapped up 4 days, really 8 days of conventions and political oratory and political speeches. Last night, of course, the centerpiece was Hillary Rodham Clinton's speech. We'll get to that in a minute. But one of the things, Rich, that I've been thinking about, and I was encouraging everybody to think about is, you know, whether political speeches – there's a sense in which this seems like kind of almost an archaic art, you know? Everything's boiled down to 8 minutes or less on YouTube, and, you know, people's attention spans are fragmented and fractured. So the notion that someone is going to speak for 40 or 50 minutes about their political aspirations and their dreams for America, it really seems like maybe something that wouldn't even have much of a role in American public life anymore. But I don't know. They have these conventions, and maybe it does. And I know that you feel, anyway, as though both members of the Obama family, the first family, have done a lot for that.
Yeah, they've got it right. What I feel that the Obamas have gotten right with oratory is the ability to actually genuinely connect with people, not just through the words that they're using, but with the ability to get in and have access to the heartbeat. so that we're getting involved in the sort of the biological rhythm of the crowd. And that's a thing that I just haven't seen actually, I'd never seen it before. The only places I'd seen it were recorded things because
right.
they predated me.
Yes.
So to be able to witness them do their thing made me feel really sorry for the folks who came after them because that was a sort of a tough act to follow for sure.
Well, sir, obviously, President Obama made his mark on the world in 2004 with a speech. A speech, by the way, that was less than 20 minutes in length. It was the length that was the famous keynote speech from Boston at the John Kerry Convention. And the world was kind of never Obama-free after that. I mean, it kind of just sort of changed the political landscape, at least of the Democratic Party. That's how big a speech can be. But Irene, as somebody who sort of teaches in the world of writing and rhetoric, I mean, I don't know. Maybe the words that came out of my mouth at the beginning were blasphemy to you, but I'm amazed that political oratory is something that anybody gravitates towards.
You know, I when you said that, I was just thinking, yeah, wow, that's true. I mean, just I went to a big arena concert recently. It was Nile Rodgers and Duran Duran, and I thought, wow, this is a whole world. Like, there's all these people who spend a lot of money to go to these giant events and hear concerts, and that. So now I'm thinking that in a way, there's something about speeches that's similar, you know, that we want, that people still do. They still go and hear Donald Trump or whoever's running, and they want to listen. And there's some kind of attention span or interest that people still have in our world of 8-minute sound bites in some kind of long shared thing. Because the whole thing about a speech is that there's so many people there. You can't give a speech on the radio, or you could, but it's different. So there's something about the giant arena that actually is appealing, as it was thousands of years ago when Aristotle wrote about it. You know. So anyway, that's my first thought.
All right. Well, maybe, Jim, it is time to kick the tripwires a little bit and step on the third rails and all that kind of stuff. So Hillary Clinton coming at the end of a week that had some pretty good speeches in it. Michelle Obama ruled on Monday night. Bill Clinton probably owned Tuesday night. Joe Biden and Barack Obama both giving memorable speeches. You can maybe throw Tim Kaine in there, although he's not really my cup of tea on Wednesday night. But Thursday night was Hillary Clinton.
But he is your neighbor.
He's my neighbor.
He's your kooky neighbor.
Or as we pointed out yesterday, he's your stepdad. He's your new stepdad.
Yeah, right.
But why isn't he your cup of tea? What is it about him that you don't – that?
I think ultimately that he's a guy in search of a persona that – I mean, we did have Alexandra.
He's a little vanilla.
Yeah, we had Alexandra Petri yesterday. And she was basically saying why he's your stepdad, that he's he'll give you kind of a stern little lecture, but he'll also fold your laundry for you, you know. And you know, yeah. I mean, if you come in late from your curfew, he won't tell your mom, but he'll give you a little speech about choices and, you know, prefrontal cortex development and how you're too young to be staying out this late. He's still kind of looking for that spot, but I don't think he's a particularly exciting speaker. But last night, I mean, everything was on Hillary Clinton, but she had a lot of tough acts to follow. So how'd she do?
Well, fortunately, for better or for worse, she followed Chelsea, who sounds really – I'm sorry, dude. And I'm not
– Maybe that was deliberate.
Yeah, right.
Maybe so. I mean, I think on the heels of Trump having his children and basically just his children there as proxies and surrogates, she probably felt that this would help humanize her. I don't think Chelsea was particularly well coached. But she did what she had to do, and I think Hillary did what she had to do at the end of it. And you could take the politics out of it. She delivered a pretty strong speech. The problem, I think, for her is that the Obamas spoke at this, and their bar is so high in terms of having all these chops and everything. But to Richard's point, they have heart. And they're not thinking about the speech. You could see him occasionally looking at a teleprompter. But mostly he's just out there in the moment. And to her credit, I think Hillary was kind of in the moment last night. That's not her game. Yeah, but she did sort of inhabit the moment as much as she could or had to. Well, I think it was still a success for her.
I think that gets back to the segue that Colin just had. You know, like you have to have some kind of – you have to have the what is it, the trappings, the out the thing. It's not just the content. It's a lot of other stuff, like the way your voice sounds,
oh,
the way
yeah,
you move
the,
and all that.
The chops.
But you have to have the heart, what you called heart, too. You know, that's a really, really component. You can't just have those things without it. You have to have some, or at least be able to give the audience the sense that you feel it and you believe it while you're saying it. And not everybody can do that because some people feel like they're just and Hillary a lot of the times yeah. feels like she's just going through the motions of saying all this stuff because she has all this knowledge and all that. But there was I also felt last night with her that there were some moments where you felt like she was really feeling
oh,
it
no doubt.
In
no
some
doubt.
Kind of yeah, yeah. yeah, and that's where she was really good. Even though the thing that she was feeling was the specifics about what she's going to do.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's where she lives, is policy
that's
and details.
That's what she feels, yeah.
So I have this theory, right, that there are two kinds of leaders. There's the builder, and then there's the fire starter, right? And we as an audience tend to gravitate to the fire starters, and we get inspired by that. And Hillary Clinton is a builder, by and large. And along with that, I think that she suffers from this thing that I've been calling Jan Brady syndrome, in that Jan was the smart one. She's the one that solved all the problems. She's the one that that resolved all the crises. And while the
was
other –
Was she the oldest?
She was, no, she was the middle.
The middle,
she was
okay.
the middle one. Right. While all the others created – all kinds of chaos that she had to fix and got to practice their external personas. They got to be the really cute, charming ones, or they got to be the older, cavalier ones. And Jan had to hold the whole darn thing together. So at the end of the day, when she has to be put in a position where she performs, she just does not hold up to the aesthetic of leadership that the others seem to have.
I think there are also two
poor
kinds of
Hillary
and Janice, played by Steve Buscemi. Right?
Well, I think she relishes that comparison more than the Tracy Flick one that comes up over and over again in the movie Election. We talked about that yesterday. But I think there are also two kinds of speakers. There are speakers who are essentially conversationalists. I would put both Obamas in that category, Bill Clinton in that category. I think most of the really good speakers.
Joe Biden.
Essentially. Well, Biden uses yeah. dynamics a lot, right?
He's a very chatty
yeah,
kind of
You tweeted something I thought that was very correct during his speech, was that he's a master of orchestrating the crowd and controlling the environment that he's in.
Well, especially that was a very volatile moment.
Right.
He was trying – that was the – come on, you guys. We got to do this moment.
So, was that Biden?
Yeah.
Joe Biden, yeah. So when he does those things like, where he goes, listen for a second, just don't cheer, yeah. don't boo.
Oh,
just
let me finish.
Yeah.
Let me finish this.
Yeah. So, I mean, once again, that's very conversational, very good. And then there are yellers. You know, there are yellers. Mm-hmm. Cory Booker, unfortunately, at the moment, is a yeller. Rudy Giuliani is such a yeller that it was like a Wild Kingdom moment where like someone get a tranquilizer dart yeah. And shoot him. I, for the most part, think yellers are not good speakers. I think that they are alas, Chris Dodd during his political career was a yeller. They think that they're saying something really important, so they should yell it.
Or that the yelling sort of gives it gravity mm-hmm. or more meaning.
So one of the things that comes up, and it's a source, particularly over the last 9 months, of a great amount of often rather angry dispute, is Hillary Clinton a yeller and too much of a yeller, or is it simply that when a woman tries to project, she gets accused of yelling? Last night she was far more conversational than she's for the most part been on the campaign trail. But I'm going to play just a little cut from last night to show what it is that people are referring to when they say that she yells.
If you believe that we should say no to unfair trade deals, that we should stand up to China, that we should support our steel workers and auto workers and homegrown manufacturers, then join us.
In her credit or in her defense, that was sort of an orchestrated build, you know, where she was repeating the same refrain, join us, join us, join us. On the other hand, Jim, she does – one of the things that it's hard for some speakers to believe is you have Spinal Tap 11 type amplification right now in the arena, and you're basically talking to people who are watching television anyway. You don't have to scream over the crowd noise.
Yeah, I don't know, though, that you can – although, you know, again, the Obamas are able to have incredibly intimate moments with 18,000 people in there. Mm-hmm. And good orators. I think Joe Biden did too. Bill Clinton did to a degree. I thought he was kind of ambly at times, a little bit too folksy for me sometimes. I don't know that Hillary has those chops. I don't know that that's her game to get out. And I think if you see her in a room full of people who have been through something terrible, she's on her game there. That's her thing, to relate to people one-on-one. But to project that to 18,000 people, that's a really unique and difficult thing to do. It's a very particular skill set that that also requires an instrument. And that's where we get back to the Obamas, where they are it's not a gift. It's something they've cultivated. So I think it's but you do have to have the voice. You have to be Rick Allison or somebody, one of these people who has a voice.
What were you going to say?
Well, what I noticed with both Obamas is that they have dynamic control, where they can be sort of soft-spoken, and then they could drive this thing.
And it's emotional and dynamics,
too. Exactly. And it's about not how loud they are, but how far out they place their voice. Sometimes they let their voice stay very close to them and force you to come to them. And then there are times where they push it out and they wrap you up in it. And so I just don't think that Obama is purely conversational. I mean, I think that he does conversation to pull people in really close, and then he pounds away pretty hard.
Well, yeah, so now I'm thinking that, you know, I agree with you. And so I think the build is really important. And Obama definitely speaks loudly, much more, you know, he does the build really beautifully. And so now I'm thinking probably maybe someone told Hillary, you know, yeah, it's good to sort of talk and you're in a conversation. It's good to be conversational, but you really need to build. So she was trying to build, but it just didn't suit her at all.
It doesn't suit her in general. She does it a lot. It doesn't suit her. And I am amazed because, I mean, one thing that people have said over and over again, and people like Jim who are engineers who are, you know, watching decibel levels and stuff like that, know that a woman's voice sometimes starts to sound pushed sooner than – I mean, we were talking before we went on the show. Martin Luther King could talk really, really loud and never sound like he was shouting. He just sounded like he was talking really loud, you know. And some of that is the curse probably of the difference between the sexes. But there are ways that you can fix this and ways that you can address this and speech therapists that you can work with. And I'm kind of shocked that somebody as achievement-oriented as Hillary Clinton hasn't done that.
Who were the women in this that achieved what you're talking about? Michelle. And I'm like, Elizabeth Warren kind of fell flat.
Mm. Yeah.
She was up against a different set of circumstances.
Was she shouting? I
mean, she did. She did not shout.
But she has a level of amplification.
I think it's also the message that you had to deliver. Well, I mean, Michelle got to deliver a message that was filled with range.
Right.
You know, so in the content was embedded the performance.
I'm almost going past content. I'm just thinking who was able to drill through this wall besides them in at either convention.
Mm-hmm. I would actually say Ivanka Trump might be in that category.
That's the only one I missed.
She gave a very effective speech on behalf of her father. Yeah. She didn't have to yell. She didn't have to scream. I think it's something that Clinton needs to work on. We already know. I mean, all you have to do is – I mean, they could. I'm sure they've polled on this. People don't like the way she sounds when she does that, whether that's fair or not.
And see her a year ago versus now, because about 6 weeks ago she began to temper this.
Right. Whether it's fair or not, whether it's sexist or not, it doesn't matter. It's the Game of Thrones. You have a liability.
Right. No, you're right.
You've got to fix it. It's just like the night of. You get to Rikers. You better figure out how things work here. Don't tell me you're Bambi. All right. We have to take a break. We'll come back. All right. It's time for endorsements now. Rich Holland and Jim Chapdelaine and Irene Papoulos are all here. Actually, before we endorse, really quickly, best John Turturro role. Anybody have a favorite? I'll do mine right now. Herbie Stumpel in Quiz Show. He's so, so great. Anybody else want to?
Well, Do the Right Thing.
Yeah, that's
so
what I was
going
to go with.
Yeah, that would be maybe his.
The classic.
I liked him in Barton Fink.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so that we've done that. All right, give us your.
Okay, so one thing I didn't get to say is the Muslim guy whose son died in the war, who talked at the convention last night, was so good. The way he wasn't yelling at all, and he pulled out the Constitution from his. He was such a. I think it's worth seeing him online if you haven't.
He was total substance.
But I also want to endorse the actor that plays Naz's father, Peyman Moadi, and seeing movies that are not, that have subtitles. Like, so he's in A Separation and About Ellie. He's an Iranian actor, even though he's playing Pakistani in this, and he can sort of play the. But those two movies are so good that, and his parts in those are so interesting that I recommend him.
He is just terrific. Yeah, both directed by Farhadi, who's sort of the Scorsese of Iran. Go ahead, Jim.
I have two things. There's a documentary called Miss Sharon Jones coming out about the Dap Kings and Sharon Jones wrestling with pancreatic cancer while still trying to be a vital performer. Mm. I've seen outtakes of it or clips of it, and it looks really compelling. It's sort of, I think it was made specifically for me. Mm-hmm. It's musical. It has cancer advocacy built into it. It's fascinating. I don't know if I'd tell everybody to rush out and read this, but I'm finding it an amazing book. It's by Steven Pinker. It's called The Better Angels of Our Nature, and it documents how we have far less violence and war in our society than we are led to believe by the media. And right now, the least of any time in our history, yet we have somebody who's running on a platform of this being the worst time in our history. So The Better Angels of Our Nature, I'm finding it fascinating.
All right. Rich, very cool. What have you got for us?
About last week, I think it was, about 900 people gathered at the Bushnell to hear Dr. Robert Putnam talk through the Hartford Foundation for Public Giving on the opportunity gap. And I can't remember sitting in an actual lecture and being so moved. I literally cried at parts of his conversation and was shaking throughout it for the scale of the responsibility that I feel at this point. Wow. And so I'm going to really strongly recommend that everybody go out and read his book. It's actually sitting on Hillary Clinton's nightstand. She's stating that it's one of her favorite books right now.
This is the new book, right?
Yeah. It's called Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis by Dr. Robert D. Putnam.
I was going to go to that lecture, but I knew I could get a bowling lane really easily that night, with him speaking. So I thought, let's take advantage.
Bowling alone here. Yeah.
You got to line your ducks up. It'll be so. Duck pins.
I'm going to very quickly endorse. We're going to plan a much bigger show about this for September 8th, which is the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. But the new Star Trek movie is actually really good. It gets – not really good. It's like a BB+ kind of movie. But it gets the thing that filmmakers miss about Star Trek, which is it's a workplace drama. It's about a diverse bunch of people who have to work together and tolerate each other's diversity. And even exploit each other's diversity for a common gain. So they kind of get that right. I was thrilled by that. I would also encourage people, apropos of the night of, to read one of Richard Price's novels. You can kind of take your pick. I happen to like a book called The Lush Life, which is set in the Lower East Side. But Clockers is probably the most famous one. The Wanderers was his first one. Samaritan, which I haven't read, is maybe the one that I might tackle next. I also will endorse quickly the work of Bill Camp, one of the actors that we were talking about there. When you watch Birdland and you see Michael Keaton walk by this madman on the street reciting a Shakespeare soliloquy, that's Bill Camp. And he's kind of turned into this actor's actor. You can see him in lots of other things. I just saw him in a very interesting Michael Shannon movie called Midnight Special. I also saw him on Broadway in The Crucible. So watch for Bill Camp. He gives really good performances. He's about the opposite of a glamorous actor, but he's just – did I not say Birdman?
I said
Birdman. Okay. So anyway, we're done. Thank you very much. Irene Papoulis, Rich Holland, Jim Chapdelain. We'll be back on Monday with Losers and Losing.
Vernon, I already said that one. Avon, Farmington. Yeah, 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 yeah.